and maybe hard to absorb everything I was saying. So let's do a little bit of reflection, meditation on some of the things I was talking about. To try to get a better and a deeper understanding. So try to sit in a comfortable position with your back straight but shoulders relaxed. Let your breath flow in and out in a natural way, a natural rhythm. Let your mind relax if there are thoughts of the past or the future, or other places that aren't related to right here, right now, put them aside. Decide that for this period of time, you will just keep your awareness in the present moment, right here, right now, focused on this meditation that we are doing. So let's contemplate some of the things I was talking about earlier. The Buddha said that it's very wonderful and very precious to have a human life, to be born as a human being, as compared to other kinds of beings such as animals. And not just to have a human life, a human body, but to have certain conditions in our life, like having good health, healthy body and healthy mind. So many people struggle with sickness or disabilities or chronic pain, or with mental problems that make life very difficult, make it difficult for them just to function in this world, in this life. So try to recognize that you are fortunate to have a human life and a healthy one, healthy body, healthy mind, even if you have some problems, but they're probably not so serious that you wouldn't be able to live a normal life, especially in terms of spiritual practice, being able to learn meditation, learn about Dharma, learn about the path leading to liberation, to enlightenment. So you're healthy enough to be able to engage in this kind of practice. In addition to that, we have freedom. we are not controlled by a government or other people like family members who don't allow us to go where we want and do what we want. So that's a positive thing as well. It means we can choose to come to an event like this and learn about meditation, learn about our potential and how to develop it. Nobody's stopping us from doing this. Well, another factor is that we have interest. And this is most probably because we've done it before in other lives. We also were interested in spiritual teachings and spiritual practices. And we may have engaged very seriously in such practices. And that's why in this lifetime we felt this interest. And that's a very important factor too, because a lot of people aren't interested. They don't see any reason, any relevance to such activities. So even though they could learn meditation and how to transform their minds, they just don't have the interest in doing so. So this is another reason making our life very fortunate. So the Buddha said if one has a human life and one has the opportunities to learn the Dharma, the path to higher states of mind like liberation and enlightenment, then one should really make good use of this opportunity, not waste our time. And one way of understanding that is that we don't have all the time in the world. We have a certain number of years in this life, but then this life will end. And it's not sure what will happen after this life. We will have another life, but whether we'll continue to have the same conditions we have now or not, that's not definite. We might even be in a worse situation. We might be physically handicapped or mentally handicapped or lacking freedom, or extremely impoverished, or just not having the opportunity to learn the Dharma. So while we have this life with these conditions, it's really important that we make good use of them. And the place to start is to make sure that when this life does end and our mind travels from this body, this life, to another one, that we will be able to find ourselves in good conditions, not suffering deprivation, horrible conditions, but at the very least what we have now, having a human life, having the opportunity to continue our spiritual practice and be able to continue following the path to liberation and enlightenment. And it's up to us. It's not up to anyone else. No one else decides where we're going to go in our next life. It's up to us and the kind of actions that we do, the karma that we create. So that's the main determining factors as to where we will go, what will happen to us in our future lives. And the meaning of that is it's up to our actions, our karma, the kind of karma we create. So having a human life, being born as a human being, is the result of an ethical lifestyle, which basically means refraining from harmful actions like killing, stealing, lying, any kind of physical or verbal or mental activities that's harmful to others. So refraining from those as much as possible, and then trying to do the opposite, beneficial, helpful actions with our body, speech, and mind. So if we live our life in that way, doing the best we can to avoid harming and to engage in helping behavior, that is the way to ensure that the next life and future lives after that will be positive ones, will be born in good conditions and be able to continue spiritual practice, working for liberation and enlightenment. So if that makes sense to you, then see if you can come to the conclusion that you do want to use your life well, wisely, doing things that are beneficial to yourself and to others, trying to refrain from harmful, unwise, destructive behavior that's harmful to yourself and others, and trying to engage in spiritual practice as much as you can. Okay, so you can come out of the meditation and open your eyes, relax your position. Does anyone have a question about anything I've said so far that doesn't make sense to you, or you would like to understand better?
I think you heard me earlier, right? I continue from there. So Pure Land is not the ultimate place. It's just a good place, a conducive place to practice and hopefully gain enlightenment from there. So when one is passing on, we often chant, the Amitabha mantra, or wishing to get to Pure Land. But why you wanted to take that step to go Pure Land and not wishing to gain enlightenment from there? Is it because it's like an intermediate stage, easier to achieve?
So the question is, why aspire to go to a pure land after death rather than enlightenment? I mean, it's not that easy to go to enlightenment. It's not like you have much choice. Of course, especially in Vajrayana Buddhism, there are practices one can train in during your life. And if you train in those practices very, very, very well, and you do very well in those practices, they say it is possible at the time of death to reach enlightenment. They say Lama Tsongkhapa did that. Yeah. But that's quite hard to do. So, of course, that would be the best thing if you can. If you can do that, that would be the best thing. But I think probably most people would find that too difficult to do, and especially if you haven't spent time. I mean, Lama Tsongkhapa was in retreat, very, very strict retreat for years and years and years, so he was quite an accomplished meditator. But, if you haven't that kind of experience, and you get to the end of your life, and you don't have the sort of inner equipment to be able to go straight to enlightenment, then going to a pure land is a good alternative, certainly better than being born in an animal realm or some awful place. And again, once you're in a pure land, they say you have Buddhas and Bodhisattvas all over the place teaching, and you have very good conditions to continue to practice, so you can continue practicing probably much more than you would here. You keep working towards enlightenment. So that's the idea of a pure land. Yeah, it's kind of an intermediary, between this world and enlightenment. But I remember meeting, when I was here actually, there was one visiting teacher, and his companion, attendant that came with him. We were talking about this one day, and he said, "I don't want to go to a pure land because there's no suffering there. Here in this world, there's a lot of suffering, and so you can have a lot of compassion and you can work to benefit others. But in a pure land, you don't see anybody suffering there. It's too wonderful." So that was an interesting idea that, in his point of view was it's better to come back to this world because of the suffering. But of course, you have to be able to know how to handle suffering. Some people get overwhelmed by it and get depressed about it and can't handle it. But if you have a very strong mind, you know how to handle suffering, then being in this world gives you the opportunity to really generate a lot of compassion and also do a lot of help for others and so on. So the way I think of it is, everyone is different. So depending on our abilities and our tendencies and so on, we can decide which is better, go to a pure land, come back here, go straight to enlightenment if you can. Yeah. Well, this is a tricky point. It's not the same. It's not the same as a god realm. It's different than a god realm. Well, you're not free from samsara, but it's like a way out. You're on the way out of samsara. Yeah. There's different, it's a little difficult actually to find some material about this. I do have some material on my computer. It's not in my mind, it's on my computer. So I'll look it up later. No, but Venerable Children has been working on these books. Venerable Tipton Children, who's coming here in December, she's been working on these books of teachings by the Dalai Lama, going into great depth and detail about a lot of these points, which it's actually hard to find information in other places. So she actually, you know, spoke to some lamas and got some very good information about the Pure Land. So I'll look it up and tell you about it next time. it's a little complicated, though. But yeah, that question about are they in samsara or out of samsara, it's not so clear-cut like that. Yeah, because actually a Pure Land, they say a Pure Land is actually emanated by a Buddha. It's coming from a Buddha's mind. It's a place created by a Buddha where, you know, serious practitioners can come and have good conditions to continue practicing Dharma. Whereas samsaric realms, like the God realms, they are not created by the Buddha. They are created by karma, the karma of sentient beings. It's good karma, but it's still samsara. It's still deluded. You know? So they're not the same. The Pure Land, the Buddha land, and a God realm are not the same. They're quite different. Because you go to a God realm and you just get distracted. It's like going to a 5-star hotel and, you know, wonderful pleasures. And you see, it's very difficult to practice Dharma there because you're just totally distracted by all the pleasure, all the fun. 24-hour parties, you know. It's like who wants to meditate? So, no, it's quite different. The Pure Lands, the Buddha Lands. Any other question? Yeah. Oh. Yeah, maybe it's dangerous using that microphone. Harmful to our ears.
Hello, yeah, Venerable. So my question is the jhana states of absorption, concentration. Are these taught in the Tibetan tradition?
They are, yeah. I mean, the information is there. Oops. Yeah, the information is there. The explanations are there. Monasteries, when the monks study, they do many years of study, so they do study this information. But as for practicing, you probably would have a hard time finding anybody who's actually doing those practices. Yeah. When it comes to practice, probably most Tibetan lamas are doing Vajrayana practice, or they're doing Mahamudra practice, or Dzogchen practice. There could be different reasons for that. One may be that it's not necessary. If you're practicing Vajrayana, you don't need the jhanas. You can bypass those. And there's also talk about how it's a little dangerous if you get into these jhana states because you can get really attached to the bliss and the peace and then get stuck there for a while. So, yeah. But the information is definitely there. So your friend didn't want to take the Amitabha empowerment because he didn't want to go to Sukhavati.
Yeah.
I see. I don't want to go to that Pure Land. I want another one. Well, I think that's possible, you know, that a person might feel a particular connection or affinity with a particular Buddha figure and, you know, want to go to that Pure Land and not another one. I don't think that's... you know, invalid or wrong to say.
You're distracted. Where do you go
take the wrong turn. Oops. I didn't want to come here. I mean, I haven't heard any explanation like that, but what pops up in my mind is there was this, they tell this story about this one of the great lamas in Tibet, great bodhisattva. He had great compassion, and he actually prayed to go to hell. He wanted to go to hell because he had so much compassion for the beings in hell. He wanted to go there and help them. So that was his prayer, go to hell, go to hell. So he was on his deathbed, you know, and getting close to death. And then suddenly he said, oh, no. And the disciples were really worried, you know, they're thinking, uh-oh, what's going on? And it turns out he was having visions of a pure land. And he was saying, oh, no, because he didn't want to go to a pure land. He wanted to go to hell. So the point of that is, you know, it's really up to your karma. I mean, even though he wanted to go to hell, it seems that he wasn't going to go because his karma was just so good, so pure. I think that's the moral of the story. But the real point of that is just the power of compassion, the power of compassion and love, and how, you know, that is so beneficial. If we have this genuine compassion for others and genuine wish to help others, that creates so much merit, so much good karma, you know, that even if we don't want to go to a pure land, we don't want to go to a good place, we will, because that's our karma is sending us there. So I don't know if that answers your question, but somehow, I don't know if it's possible to end up in the wrong pure land. Because you do have to, they say like to be born in Amitabha's pure land, you do have to create very specific practice, you have to do very specific practices related to Amitabha. So if you didn't do those practices, it would seem not likely you would go to that pure land. But I don't know enough about this, so I'm certainly not an expert. Don't go by what I say. But yeah, there are many different pure lands, and I sometimes wonder, well, how do you know which one you want to go to? And then I thought for myself, I think I'm just going to pray to the Buddha, please take me wherever I can go, wherever's the best place for me. You know better than me. Coming back in this world, if that's better, then let me come back here. If I going to pure land is better, then I go there. So I just, you know, pray to be born in the best situation, the situation where I can continue to practice and help others and work towards enlightenment, rather than me deciding where I want to go. Because maybe there's too much ego there as well. I don't know. Lots of interest in Pure Lands.
Hello. All right. I had the same question you had about whether I should go to Pure Land or I should come back to be reborn and as a human. So many years ago, I asked Geshe Lama Khonchok the same question. Can this disciple ask the guru to decide? Pure Land or rebirth back here? So Geshe Lama said, you have to decide. The guru does not decide that. So I was like, wow, it's difficult to decide. But he said, yeah, you have to decide it. So yeah, at that time, I was also having this dilemma, you know. It's like...
You had what?
The same dilemma. If we are supposed to have compassion to our fellow sentient beings, mm-hmm. so we come back here so that we can spend time with them, connect with them. But at the same time, what if we are not strong enough, then we get sidetracked. Then we go to hell. So then better to go to Pure Land. So then that is the question. But how would I know? How strong am I? Or is it better to go to Pure Land? It seems like abandoning the sentient beings if you go to Pure Land. That was how I felt. But yeah. Geshe Lama said, no, you have to decide.
You have to decide, yeah. Well, that's interesting. Thank you for sharing that. And I was thinking of another story. someone that I know was a very devoted disciple of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and she became quite ill. And he said to her, get ready for death, something like that, you know, get ready to die. And then I think, if I remember correctly, the story was she asked him, okay, so where should I go? Which Pure Land should I go? Should I try to go to? And he did tell her. He did give her a reply. So maybe it depends on the teacher. Maybe Lama Geshe Lama Khunchog didn't want to, you know, make that kind of decision or advice, give that kind of advice. But, you know, other teachers, for example, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, did, at least for that student. So maybe it doesn't hurt to ask. Even if the teacher says, you decide, well, okay. But the teacher might say something else, might give you some advice. So every teacher is different. Every teacher has their way of teaching and giving advice. I just want to make sure I don't go to a bad place. You know, I just want to make sure I can be in a place where I can continue to practice and develop my mind and work towards enlightenment, you know, keep going in that direction. So, watching. You're going to risk the microphone.
Oh, yes. this is pertaining to what you have mentioned yesterday, that you mentioned that you had some issue with hell, with the idea of hell. So how did you resolve?
How did I resolve that one? Yeah, it took a long time. I really had a lot of resistance to hell, and I still do. I mean, it's still, you know, not an easy one for me. But I guess what helped me, and this is also what I do when I'm teaching, is to just think about the situations in this world that are like hell. You hear stories sometimes of people who are thrown into prisons and, you know, they go through horrible experiences and they're tortured and, you know, it's really like hell. Or another example, you know, if a person is in a fire and, you know, their whole body is burned. I mean, you know, we know what it's like just to have one tiny little bit of skin burned. It's so painful. You know, so to have their whole body burned, oh, that would be like hell. And also, I think mentally, you know, people sometimes have a mental illness that could be like hell. For example, paranoia, you know, thinking everyone is your enemy, everyone hates you, everyone's trying to kill you, no matter what they say, no matter what they do, your mind interprets it, twists it in a negative way. I knew somebody like that. She was living in a Dharma center. Right? Everybody was nice, but she saw everybody as trying to kill her, trying to poison her. And I thought, oh, that's like hell. You can't trust anybody. She didn't even want to eat the food because she thought, you know, they were putting poison in the food. So that's like a mental hell. So I think it's clear that people, human beings around us in this world, have experiences, whether they're physical or mental or both, that are hell-like, right? Just terrible, terrible suffering. So when I think about those kinds of experiences, then I realize I cannot deny hell. You know, I can't say there's no such thing as hell, because human beings experience things that are like hell. And in fact, some teachers, some Dharma teachers, even talk about hell and the other realms as experiences within the human realm. You know, that there are human experiences that are like hell, human experiences that are like the hungry ghost realm. An example of that would be like drug addicts, heroin addicts, or alcoholics who just have this intense craving for their drug, and that just takes over their life. You know, that's all they care about in their life is getting their drug, getting their bottle, you know. And it's just suffering. They're never satisfied, never really satisfied. So that would be similar to the hungry ghost realm. And also, you know, people who are starving. Right now in Yemen, so many people are starving, don't have enough to eat. In many other places in the world, people just don't get enough to eat. In India, you see all these people that are just skin and bones. So that's similar to the hungry ghost realm. And then animal realm? Well, the animal realm is obvious. They're our neighbors. We're sharing this world with them. Yeah, so thinking about the different kinds of experiences that happen just in this world helped me to open up more to these other realms. But then some teachers, for example, the Dalai Lama, say, but these other realms aren't just here in the human realm. They do exist. There are actual places where one finds oneself. And that's like the whole realm. The whole realm is like that. And I guess my resistance has gone down. Because I think, you know, if you have really strong negative karma, for example, a terrorist, you know, if you took delight in killing people, blowing people up, you know, creating suffering for people, and you actually enjoyed that, you felt good about that, you wanted to do it again and again and again. So that kind of mind, you know, and that kind of karma, I think definitely would lead to being in a hell-like experience, some kind of hell. Because that's what Shantideva says. Shantideva says, you know, who created hell? It's our mind. These realms are created by our mind. When our mind indulges in really negative states and negative behavior, negative karma, that's where hell comes from. And I can accept that. I don't like the idea of it, but... And a few months ago, I was in San Francisco, and I was just there for about a week, and some friends, some nuns who were there, were saying, oh, you have to go and see this exhibit. It was in the Asian Art Museum, and it was something about hell. And like, you know, paintings about hell. Didn't sound too great, but I was interested, so I went along. And it turns out this man, American man, his name is Sam Burkles, and he started the Shambhala Publishing Company. It's one of the first Buddhist, you know, spiritual publishing companies in America. It's still publishing books, Shambhala Publishing. So the founder, his name is Sam Burkles. So apparently he had some kind of, like he had a heart attack or something, and then he had this near-death experience. He was in this state of mind, altered state of mind for a period of time, and he actually went to hell. He had these experiences of going to hell. And it didn't sound, there was a book related to this that explained the whole story, but I didn't have a chance to read the book. It didn't sound like he was born in hell, but more like he was taking a journey. You know, a guided tour of hell. But he would meet some of the people there and hear their stories, you know, what did they do to end up in hell? And I guess the visions, everything was just so vivid and so clear. When he came back to normal, he told a few people about it, and finally he met one lama. And the Lama said, oh, that's normal, you know, like lots of people have that kind of experience. In Tibetan, they have this term delog. And these are people who actually travel out of their body and they go to other realms. And this Lama said, you're the first Caucasian delog I've ever met, you know. But in Tibet, lots of people have these experiences. So then he met a Tibetan artist. And they collaborated so that he described his visions and the artist painted them. So that's what was on display in this art museum, these paintings of hell. And many of them, well, there was one that was actually very similar to one of the hells described in the Lam Rim. There was this guy I guess during his life, he was totally infatuated with this woman. He was just completely obsessed with this woman. So he was born in this hell, and he would hear her voice calling him from the top of this tree, and he would go running up this tree to, you know, get to her, and the leaves of the trees turned into swords. You remember that one? That's in the Lam Rim. And, you know, he'd get all cut up, and then there were these birds with sharp beaks who would come and poke him and so on. So that one was very similar to what is described in the Lam Rim. And I don't remember all the others. Yeah, there was one that was especially for terrorists. One hell for terrorists. So there was, you know, one guy there. And in that hell, they just kept getting blown up again and again. Just like what they did in this life, you know, blowing people up. This is what they went through, getting themselves blown up again and again. Which makes sense, doesn't it? You do that to others, it's going to happen to you. So, yeah, this is a new hell we can add to the Lam Rim, the terrorist hell. So, I don't know if that's answering your question, but I'll try to find information. You might be able to find something on the internet if you're interested. But there was a book about it, a book about these paintings and the story behind them. So, probably this man believes in hell. I mean, he was there. He saw them out of his body, you know. And there's lots of people who have out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences, but many of them are beautiful. You know, they meet these celestial beings and they see these lights and they meet old relatives, old loved ones. So those are the beautiful out-of-body or near-death experiences. But yeah, there can also be these frightening ones. So I think, you know, you would have a very strong determination to practice Dharma if you had those kind of experiences. Actually, I read a story. Saint Teresa, one of the Catholic saints. There's a few Saint Teresas, but the one who was a mystic, Saint Teresa of Avila in Spain, 16th century or so. And yeah, she had all these wonderful visions, and she would sometimes even float off the ground. You know, her body would be up in the air because she was just in this state of ecstasy, seeing God and the angels and everything. Just so she had lots of blissful, beautiful, wonderful experiences, but it seems that one time she had a vision of hell. She saw hell. And she said that was actually the best experience she had because it really was very, you know, powerful for her practice, to really make sure she practiced well and didn't do naughty things and so on. So that's the purpose. The purpose of thinking about hell and meditating on hell isn't to get scared, but it's to make sure that we don't end up there, that we don't do negative things, because that's what leads to those experiences. And just create as much virtue and good karma as we possibly can, which basically means being a good person, being kind and helpful to others and not harmful to others. That's kind of the bottom line. And if we do make mistakes, we do negative things, it's not like, oh, we're doomed, you know, we're going to go to hell and there's nothing we can do about it. It's not like that, because we have the practice of purification. We can purify our karma. So the things we can do to clear up our karma. So that's another thing we do in our tradition. I think people who follow this tradition, you know, every day we do some purification practice, like the 35 Buddhas or Vajrasattva. So as long as we're continuing to purify the karma we create and creating good karma, and refuge, of course. Refuge is also very important. They say if you can take refuge at the time of death, before dying, then you definitely will not go to a bad place, any of the lower realms. So there are ways to avoid it. So we just have to make sure we, you know, avoid that and do the things that will lead to a fortunate rebirth instead. Is that answering the question? Anyone else?
What is the best mantra to help animals?
Mantra to help animals?
Like have a precious rebirth as a human?
Well, I think any mantra is good, but I think Lama Zopa Rinpoche recommends the Medicine Buddha mantra. You know Medicine Buddha? Where's the Medicine Buddha? Yeah, there's the Tanka of Medicine Buddha. Also, there's statues. There's actually 7 Medicine Buddhas. But the main one is this one, the blue one, blue Buddha. And the mantra for that is, there's a short one and a long one. The short one is Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Rajasamagate Soha. It's a little bit long, but yeah, Rinpoche says that's a really good one to recite for animals, especially before they die. If they're dying, recite that mantra and that will protect them from lower rebirth. But if that's too difficult, Om Mani Padme Hum is good too. This is the mantra of Chenrezig, this wonderful statue behind. And that's so short and easy, Om Mani Padme Hum. That's so difficult to learn. But because Chenrezig has compassion. Chenrezig is the Tibetan name and Avalokiteshvara is the Sanskrit name and Kuan Yin is the Chinese name. So Chenrezig has compassion for all beings, every living being in the universe and all the different realms and is always constantly trying to help all living beings. That's why he has all these arms sticking out, reaching out, you know, to help everybody. And so, you know, making a connection with Chenrezig, reciting that mantra and praying that Chenrezig will take care of this being, I think that's also a good thing to do. That's a good question. Cecilia has a question.
I actually have kind of 2 questions, if I may. Buddha was omniscient, right? So he kind of revealed everything. So I'm getting an issue now with something like some of the teachings is almost like, you know, we categorize them as Buddhist beliefs, like karma, for example, or the hell realms. But I'm beginning to think more and more that it's not a Buddhist belief. Karma is not a Buddhist thing. It's like, if you're not a Buddhist, then karma doesn't apply to you. I don't think it works like that. So, yeah, I guess my question is basically that, you know, I mean, of course, there are esoteric Buddhist teachings like Vajrayana and so on, but certain things to me just seems to be Buddha's exposition of what reality actually is. You know, the description of the hells is so... And my second question relates to hell.
What was the first one?
The first one is trying to figure out, like, you know, like okay. Certain things, like, you know, when you present, like, even... renunciation, you know, reflection on the lower realms, reflection on karma, and it's all under the heading of Buddhist teachings. But to me, it seems like it's not Buddhist per se. They are really like universal truths, if I may use that term.
You mean not exclusive to Buddhism?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think if you're a Christian or a Muslim, it doesn't mean the laws of karma doesn't apply.
I mean, in the Bible, you know, it says, what you sow, you will reap.
Yes, I actually mentioned that.
They don't use the word karma, but they're talking about the same thing. Yeah?
But that's my point exactly, Venerable, because I have these very close Christian friends, and they kind of like, you know, roll their eyes when they are with me. And you know, I actually tried and talked a little bit about karma, and I said, yeah, well, it's like Christianity, you know, you reap what you sow. But she looked at me and she said, oh, that's Old Testament. And I had no idea what that meant. Like, oh, it's not Christianity, it's Old Testament.
It's not valid anymore?
Yeah, it seemed, no. I didn't know enough about Christianity to respond. So it's like, huh? You know, so like I said, it seems to me that certain things seems to me like more to be just the truth as revealed by the Buddha rather than a category like karma is Buddha's teachings.
Yeah, I think that way, at least with many of the teachings that the Buddha gave. They're really just common sense, you know. It's not exclusively Buddhist. But yeah, if you hurt somebody, if you say hurtful words to somebody, I mean, even immediately you get some bad result. You feel bad, right? You suffer. And you can see the other person suffers too. And that will make you suffer even more, okay? So you're hurting yourself, you're hurting the other person. You can see that immediately. You don't have to look into Buddhist philosophy and see what did Buddha say about this. You just look at your own experience. And yeah, I think all religions and spiritual traditions have this kind of idea that you have to be kind and helpful to others and not harmful to others. And otherwise you create suffering. So I mean, of course, the karma isn't talking about just the immediate experience. It's talking about a more long-term thing. So that's more difficult to understand, more difficult to accept, because we can't see. You know, we can't see the future. So that's why they say we have to rely on someone like the Buddha, who is able to see the past and the future. But then people may say, well, how do we know he's right? But they say that even before Buddhahood, when you develop especially concentration and the jhanas, you start to have these experiences. They're called clairvoyances or super knowledges, you know, these unusual mental experiences. And you can start seeing past lives, yourself, your own and others, and future things as well. So when you can start having those kind of your own first-hand direct experiences, then it's not like, oh, do I believe the Buddha or not? Because you know for yourself it's true. So, and I think probably the same would happen in other religions as well. In Christianity and Islam, there are people who attain these states of mind, these concentrations, even if they didn't call it that. Like St. Teresa of Avila, you know, and she had these blissful experiences. It's probably some kind of concentration, some jhana. And so they also talk about hell. You know, they have visions of these other realms, these other states, and the importance of doing good and avoiding evil so that you don't go to those places. So you find very similar. The words may be different, but the basic ideas are there. Islam as well. We talk about heaven and hell and the importance of doing good and avoiding bad, right? So you find those in all religions. So, no, I don't think these are just Buddhist teachings. And Hinduism as well. The idea of karma and reincarnation are there.
My other question relates back to hell realms. We are always told we've I think Lama Khunchuk or one of the other lamas have always said we've spent the longest time in the hell realms, and this is like one of the lucky breaks we had when we got to be a human being. Number one is, I have an issue is if we have been there so long, why can't we remember? And number two, I'm just speaking for myself personally. There isn't enough fear of going to the hell realms. I'm very sloppy with the way I practice my karma. So I don't know, there just doesn't seem to be enough fear, because when you read the Lam Rim presentation, it is so intense and so extreme. And you know the Buddha is not making this up. You know that for sure. But somehow there's like this mental... Yeah. Mm. So if we... Basically, if we've been there for a long, long time, you would imagine that it would come... Some of it would seep into this life that you would be more careful.
Well, as far as remembering bad experiences, I mean, just in this lifetime, when people have bad experiences, the mind blocks it out, right? Trauma, you forget. It's so bad, you just don't want to have it in your conscious memory anymore. So that could be an explanation for why we can't remember hell or any of these other, huh? Yeah, yeah, we want to forget the bad things. So I think to say, well, I don't remember being in hell, therefore it probably didn't happen. I don't think that would be a valid reason. Yeah, because there's a lot of things we don't remember, but that doesn't mean they didn't happen. Sometimes you can't even remember what you ate for breakfast this morning, right? But, huh? Yeah. And then this thing about fear, I mean, this is actually another issue I have, and I know many Westerners as well, when we're teaching Buddhism in the West, a lot of people say they don't want to be motivated by fear. They don't feel that is a good motivation to keep you practicing. And I've actually heard the Dalai Lama talking about this, because over, the last 5 years or so, he keeps telling this story again and again. And when he tells the story, he laughs so hard. Sometimes he can't even finish the story. But the story is about some lama in Tibet who was an abbot of a temple. And some people came to visit the temple and they wanted to meet this lama. And the attendant was there and he said, "Oh, he's gone to the village to scare the old people." So apparently what this lama would do is he'd go to the village and he'd give talks, and what he would do is talk about hell. And, if you don't do what I say, you're going to go to hell. That kind of message, And the Dalai Lama, he seems to think this is so funny that this lama was teaching in that way. And I actually heard him say once that this lama didn't know how to teach, that this is not the right way to teach. Right? To scare people. Yeah? That scaring people isn't the appropriate way of teaching the Dharma. This is what His Holiness seems to be saying. And that's given me great relief. Because I feel the same way, I think there can be other valid motivations for practicing Dharma besides being terrified of hell. So what I wonder sometimes is, when I hear stories about Tibet, it sounds like they were pretty wild. At least some of the people. Yeah, we know there were also some amazing saints, but there were also some pretty wild bandits, and naughty people doing naughty things. So maybe in Tibet, because it was a bit of like the Wild West kind of, maybe they needed that kind of teaching. They really needed, tough. The stick, yeah, the stick approach rather than the carrot approach. But then when I think of Western people, not that we're so well-behaved, but, maybe we're not quite as wild as that. Maybe the carrot approach is better. So maybe for some people, the stick works better. For some people, the carrot works better. But sometimes the stick approach just turns people off. They just walk away. They don't want to know. They don't want to hear this anymore. So that's not so helpful. Not so skillful. And that seems to be what the Dalai Lama's been saying, what I've heard him saying. That he thinks it's more skillful to talk about the good results that we will get from practice. These blissful states of jhanas, if we practice meditation, and good rebirths, and liberation, enlightenment. So if we focus more on the good results that we'll get from our practice, then that will inspire us. So maybe there's just different approaches for different people. Maybe for some people, the hellfire and brimstone approach, because that used to exist in Christianity in the West, and it doesn't work anymore. People don't like it. It just turns people off. You're going to go to hell if you don't do this, So, yeah, I think nowadays in the world, the the carrot approach works better. That's what I feel, and that seems to be what the Dalai Lama is saying as well. But also maybe at different times in our practice, you know, maybe if we do see ourselves sliding in the direction of doing something really bad, then it might be good to remember the bad stuff that could happen to us. But maybe not on a daily basis. Yeah. I don't know, is that answering the question? Also, Buddha nature. You know, I find that this is something that for myself, and I think for many people in the West, the thing that really inspires us to want to study and practice is the whole idea of Buddha nature. We have this pure nature within our mind. It's lying there like a diamond, you know? A diamond that's in the earth and just needs to be dug out and cleaned up, and then it can shine, and, you know, this beautiful gem. It's like we have this beautiful diamond inside of our mind, our Buddha nature, and we just need to bring it out and polish it and clean it up and then be able to shine as a Buddha. So that's such an inspiring, and it's something we don't have in the West, you know. We don't have that in Christianity or Islam. It's only in Buddhism that has that whole idea of the possibility of becoming a Buddha. So I think that approach works, at least for European, Western people, that works better. Yes.
Yeah, Venerable. Maybe my question is related with her question. I'm wondering, so if the fact that we are reborn as human beings is the consequence of like accumulating good karma in our past lives, how come we can so easily forget about it and doing something horrible things in this life? And does it mean that if someone actually did a horrible thing, it's a kind of like a reset our good karma and starting from the zero point, something like that?
Sorry, I didn't understand the last part.
If after like accumulating good karma, and in this life, if we are doing something really bad, does it mean that like we are resetting our good karma and starting from the zero point?
Resetting?
Yeah, like starting from the zero point. Yeah.
Well, karma is very complex, you know, as I understand it, because they say we've had so many lifetimes before this one, uncountable number of lifetimes. And in all those lifetimes, we've created all kinds of karma. And we're still carrying most of that karma, the karma that hasn't yet been ripened or purified is still with us. So we have this huge collection of different kinds of karma. Some of it's good karma, some of it's bad karma. And it depends on different conditions, like in our last life, just before we died, whatever conditions were happening at that time would have caused one of our karmas to come up and be the cause for this lifetime. And you're right that being born as a human being, especially having a healthy body, having, you know, good environment, freedom, and so forth, having all the good conditions we have in this life is definitely the result of good karma that we created. So we must have... We wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have these bodies, and we wouldn't be in a wonderful place like Singapore. I mean, Singapore has problems, but I just came from India, and I tell you. I heard this story recently that just really, it's crazy. The Indian government built a statue. It's the biggest statue in the world. I forget how big it is, but it's bigger than any statue in the world of an Indian politician. It's cost $430 million. Why? All these people living on the streets, little kids, you know, hardly anything to eat, hardly any clothes to wear, all this suffering, you know, they're not taking care of that. They're building this big statue. Anyway, it doesn't make any sense at all. And the air is polluted, the ground is polluted. It's so nice to come to Singapore and see it so clean. You sweep the streets and you have nice buildings. There's all these unfinished buildings. People start building and then it's just left there for years without being finished. It looks horrible. So it's really nice to come to Singapore and see how the government cares for the people. Okay, so anyway, being born in a good situation, having good conditions, is the result of good karma. So we must have created good karma in the past. But that doesn't mean we have only good karma and no bad karma. We have some bad karma as well. And so our bad karma can ripen during our life in different ways. It might come up as sickness or accidents or different kinds of problems. Or it could also come up as tendencies to become a murderer, to become a drug dealer, or get involved in a gang or become a terrorist. So that's the bad karma coming up, bad karma ripening. But just because bad karma comes up and ripens and you have some bad experience or you do something bad, that doesn't mean all your good karma gets wiped out. You still have that good karma there too. Okay, and that will ripen later in some other time. However, they do say it's possible to destroy good karma, which we definitely don't want to do, but it can happen, mainly by getting angry. So if we get really angry, especially at a bodhisattva, that's wipes out a lot of our good karma. So they say really be careful with anger. And that's also a reason for dedicating merit. So we create merit, we do good things, we create merit, we need to dedicate it to the welfare of all beings, and that will protect our merit, our good karma, from being destroyed. So it's important to understand about karma. It is complex, it's complicated, but the more you understand karma, the more you know how to create good karma, how to protect the good karma you create, how to avoid creating bad karma, how to purify bad karma you have created, so you can, have more control over your karma. But people who don't know about karma, how to work with karma, then they're in more danger of creating bad karma, losing good karma, and so on. So I don't know if I answered your question or not, but but it is strange, isn't it? That somebody could have so much good karma to be born as a human being and then end up using their human life to create such horrible bad karma. It is strange. But then on the other hand, I don't know if you heard the story of Milarepa. Milarepa was this Tibetan, he lived about 1,000 years ago, but more than that. Anyway, he was an interesting story. In the early part of his life, he had a tragic childhood, but then he became a black magician. He was practicing black magic. His mother pushed him to do it, to get revenge on their evil relatives. And so he became really good at black magic, and he caused the death of about 35 people, killed 35 people, plus some animals, and he destroyed crops of these people, and so on and so forth. So he did some bad stuff. Then he felt real strong regret and also fear. What's going to happen to me because of all this bad karma I've created? And then he wanted to practice Dharma. So he set out and found a teacher and practiced. And in that same lifetime, became enlightened. Went all the way to Buddhahood in that same lifetime. But then they say he was a pundit. He was a scholar for 500 lifetimes before. That's why he was able to go so fast. But then you'd think, well, so if he was a Buddhist or scholar or whatever for 500 lifetimes, why did he end up creating this bad karma? Well, I don't know the answer to that. But it just shows how complex karma is. So even in the midst of a lot of good karma, there can be some bad karma. And in the midst of some bad karma, there can be some good karma. It's just very, very complex. But I encourage you to study, because there's a lot of information about karma that's very helpful, very useful. And also knowing that, having that information isn't just to store it up here in our head, but to put it into practice in our life and help others also to, when we can. I mean, we can't force people, to create good karma, But we can at least try to share what we know with them and help them to live more in accordance with karma. So I actually had more information, but we've run out of time. But anyway, this is a kind of introduction to Tibetan Buddhism. And then next weekend, I'm talking about thought transformation, which is related to bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the second of the three principal aspects of the path. So next weekend, I'll talk about bodhicitta, how to develop bodhicitta, and then we'll go into the topic of thought transformation, which is connected with that. And then the topic of emptiness, the third of the three principal aspects of the path, we'll get to that, I think, the following weekend, when I have to talk about Heart Sutra. I'm supposed to teach Heart Sutra. So that's about emptiness. So I can explain that then. So anyway, I didn't finish everything I wanted to talk about, but I think I was overambitious. And I hope this has been helpful for you. Oh, one more question? You have a question. Okay. Use the microphone because you're very far away.
Yeah, I just... Venerable, I just want a point of clarification. You put up a slide yesterday. You had this comparison between Theravada and Tibetan tradition.
Mahayana.
Right? Yeah, Mahayana. Okay.
Yeah.
So for Theravada, I think I saw this like liberation and arahan, right? The end result, I think. Yeah. So for Tibetan, Mahayana, you have this Buddhahood and omniscience. So for liberation, does liberation equivalent to enlightenment? Is it the same?
Well, the term enlightenment is a little tricky because as I've studied it in our tradition, we actually say there's three kinds of enlightenment.
Three kinds.
Three kinds of enlightenment. One is
one
the
time,
enlightenment...
One kind, huh? Sorry.
No, it's okay. So one is the enlightenment of a shravaka. Shravaka is sometimes translated as a hearer, and that's a person who wishes to attain liberation, nirvana. They follow the Buddha's teachings and they liberate themselves. They free themselves from the cycle of death and rebirth and suffering and so forth. So they achieve a certain kind of enlightenment, a shravaka enlightenment. The second is the enlightenment of a pratyeka Buddha, a solitary realizer. This is another type of follower of the Buddha, and they're sometimes called the term solitary realizer because in their final life, they also aspire to attain nirvana, liberate themselves from cyclic existence. But they make this vow, this promise that in their final life, when they attain nirvana, they will be in a place where there's no Buddha. So they're kind of by themselves and you know, finishing their practice and reaching enlightenment. So that's also called enlightenment. But those two kinds of enlightenment are actually nirvana in the sense that you freed yourself, you've gotten yourself out of samsara, freed yourself from suffering and the causes of suffering. But then the third kind of enlightenment is Buddhahood, and that's the enlightenment in the Mahayana, and that is the state of a Buddha, and it isn't the same. Actually, these three kinds of enlightenment are not exactly the same, so the state of a Buddha is actually more than just freeing yourself from cyclic existence. You have more abilities, more qualities to be able to help others, and it takes longer. The first two kinds of enlightenment take less time. But, for example, the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, it said he spent three countless great eons on the path to reach enlightenment. So the Buddhahood takes a long time because you're doing a lot more work, you're developing yourself a lot more to be able to benefit others. So they're all three enlightenments are the same in being free of samsara, being free of death and rebirth and suffering. They're equal in that way. But in terms of the qualities and the abilities, they're not the same. A Buddha has more. So that's just a brief answer. Does that make sense?
I don't know, because I'm still choosing. I don't know what I'm going to do.
You feel
Mahayana, Theravada, I still don't know.
Oh, I see. Well, it's good to study. It's good to study and learn and then make an informed choice rather than just an emotional choice. You know, oh, I like that teacher or I like that group. You know, don't decide on that kind of basis, but rather study and get to understand the different traditions.
Yeah, but
and then you'll probably get a feeling. You'll feel, this is the one for me. So take your time. You don't need to rush.
Yeah, but finding a teacher is so difficult.
Well, you don't have to find a teacher right away. You can just go to places where teachings are given, listen to the teachings, study books. So study. And of course, you know, you have a teacher explaining that to you, but that doesn't mean, just because you're going to those classes means, oh, this is my teacher and I have to connect with that teacher and make a kind of commitment to that teacher. Not necessary. Initially, just study, learn, get informed as much as you can. And later you can decide who you want to commit yourself to as far as teachers go. You don't have to do that in the beginning. Better not to. Better to take your time.
Okay, thank you, Venerable.
Thank you for your interest. Okay, so we'll finish by making a dedication of the positive energy we've created today and also yesterday, spending our time coming here in this terrible weather, thunderstorms and rain and so on, but making the effort to come. And then spending this time sitting here, listening, thinking, asking questions, discussing, meditating. So doing all these activities, especially we did it with the wish to benefit ourselves and others. So that's altruism, that's compassion, that's a really, really good motivation. So doing things with that motivation means we've created some really good energy, what we call merit. And this is the cause of happiness and the cause of spiritual growth, our mind progressing on the path. So let's share this merit with all other beings. May it bring peace, happiness, well-being, positive states of mind like love, compassion, and may it help everyone stop having negative states of mind like hatred and aggression and the wish to harm and be free of all their suffering and causes of suffering. May it help all of us get closer to enlightenment. Gewa din yur du dog lama sanghe druk yur ne Drowa chik yang malupa de salaga parsho Chang chup sem chok rimbo che Ma ke pa nam ke gyur ching Ke pa nyam pa me pa yang Gone gondu pelpar sho gangri rawe korwe shinkam dir pendang dewa malu jungwe ne chenre zig wang tenzin gyatso yi shape site pardu ten gyur ching. Okay, thank you very much. Have a good evening and hope to meet you again. I'm just wondering.